Hello, everybody. This is Josh Placer from GameWisdom.com, where we examine the art and science of games. Welcome to another great episode of the Perceptive Podcast. For tonight's cast, we are going to be talking to Beta Dwarf once again. As you know, we spoke to them, I believe it was either late 2014 or early 2015. They were working on the game Forced at the time. Since then, a lot has been going on with the studio. They had a successful Kickstarter and release on a sequel, Forced Showdown, which I ran reviews on, and there's been several videos of them on the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. My guest tonight is the lead designer on the original Forced Showdown and their recent drone expansion. And we're going to be talking to him about sort of what's been going on with the studio, as well as how the game has really changed in terms of the first to the second and where it's at now. So please welcome from Beta Dwarf, Peter.
Thank you very much.
Peter, it's great to have you on. If you wouldn't mind, would you mind pronouncing your last name? I didn't want to butcher it too much on the podcast.
Yeah, sure. It's B-U-J-E. And in here in Denmark, we just say Bouye. So it almost sounds French, even though it's totally not. It's just a weird last name, even in Denmark. So Bouye.
Beer. Thank you for saying that, Pierre, because I'm fairly certain that I would have butchered that on the cast very easily.
Yeah, but even Danish speakers don't know how to pronounce it. Nobody does, so it would be totally fine. But yeah, Peter is fine.
All right, Pierre. It's great to have you on the cast tonight. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. It's a little late, so I've just come home from the office, and now I'm ready to talk for a while.
And for those of you listening to this cast, as you may or may not know, Beta Dwarf, Peter, you are in the Netherlands or Denmark?
Denmark,
yeah.
Copenhagen.
And it's always crazy when we have these international cast. I know when I spoke with Stefan, I think it was like about a year or so ago, I think we had our cast like early in the morning, because again, it's like a 5 or 6 hour time difference, I think, between us.
Something like that.
Yeah, but that's one of those weird things that I've really like have to experience now as I've been doing more of these podcasts, is trying to set up these times, especially with international contacts. It's always interesting to get that time difference, right? I've spoken to people where it's like, I spoke to Charles from Jara Technology. We're in Malaysia. I was like, I think it's like tomorrow there right now. Yeah. And it's always weird when we're having these conversations.
Yeah, we kind of get used to it. Being in Denmark, we work with a lot of American companies or partners all around the world. So it's like, you have to get used to, like, if you send an email, the response is probably going to come the day after or something, yeah, because people are sleeping. But yeah, it's
all right.
It's all right.
Yeah. So, Peter, it is great to have you on the cast tonight. I guess to start things off, since this is your first time on, yeah, if you wouldn't mind telling everyone like a little bit about what you do and kind of your role at Beta Dwarf.
Yeah, sure. Let's start at the beginning just for fun, because initially I joined the company when they were still like working out from a classroom. I don't know if you know the story, but
yeah,
but the story is kind of weird, where the company was founded in a classroom, like an abandoned classroom at a school that was we just kind of squatted there, and I joined shortly after that. And was pretty surprised that those guys were there, but I thought it was cool, and I thought, yeah, I'll help them out for like a month or so. Mm-hmm. So initially, I was supposed to be doing level design and web design. And they were just glad that I could do like a little of both. And then I ended up being sort of like the lead designer, working together with Stefan, the game director, like with the vision of Forced One, but also that also involved making a lot of levels, of course, populating and like planning out the puzzles and so on, was mainly and the mechanics of the game was mainly me and my fellow designers. But when people ask me what I do, I say designer or game designer. But sometimes people are not sure what that means, and it's the way I usually describe it is I make the rules of the game, and that sounds kind of simple. But if you have a blank slate, like a game usually is, then you have to define everything almost. So how much health, how much damage, how many enemies, what kind of levels, when should the enemies come at you, and all everything. You have to design every rule and with the player in mind. So I have to design or figure out how the game should play out in terms of rules and so on, and levels, geometry and so on, to give the players the best experience. So I'm sort of like speaking on behalf of the player of what's going to be fun for them. And that sounds a bit arrogant that I know exactly what the players want and I don't. That's why we do a lot of play testing to find out if my or our assumptions about what the player thinks is fun are actually true. And not only thinks is fun, but also do they understand this? That's a big part of it. Like, does this make sense in the player's mind? Like, is it intuitive?
And that is always a challenge. And it's one of those things that if you don't study game design or you don't talk to people about, it sounds like something very simple or something very innocuous to do. But I am sure, as you can definitely attest to this, Peter, when you're starting from that blank slate and you have to build that experience up, it is very challenging. And again, we could easily spend 3-4 hours just like talking about like the basics or like just like some like the beginner's things you have to start thinking about when you're essentially building a game out of thin air.
Yeah. Usually you will have some constraints like the engine you're using or the expertise you have on the team will design like a framework you have to work within, or even time and money in most cases is what defines how big you can go with your ideas and scope.
Yeah. And a lot of the challenges, especially for independent developers, is just knowing how far they can push their scope out. When I spoke with Adrian from Abbey Games, who did Renowned Explorers last year, he talked about how they decided to go, you know, completely big with the idea and almost like drove them crazy trying to build that game up. And it's what we see a lot when developers essentially go from having like no idea to something completely unique or original. And part of that challenge, again, is the fact that you don't have a quote-unquote baseline or a foundation to look at. When you're basically building something from scratch, it's why a lot of first games definitely can be rough around the edges, because you simply don't know anything else at that time.
And especially Forced One took a long time to make, because we basically also had to, while we were making the game, we also had to learn how to make games, both technically, but also just what works and what doesn't. So it took quite a while to make that game. And the final version of Force was basically remade 3 times or something. So it didn't look or feel like it did in the final version at all in the beginning. It was something completely different.
But
that's part of it.
And I hear that also from a lot of developers, that very rarely, outside of like your core foundation or your basic gameplay feedback loop, everything else about your game can change radically over, you know, from start to middle to finish. And even sometimes, you know, multiple times in those pieces, we've seen developers just experiment or go in radical different form, different ways or mechanics.
Yeah, actually, when I joined the project, they had just switched from a totally different like Facebook adventure game where you, if you died, you had to pay to revive or something silly like that, mm-hmm. and they had just come up with the orb mechanic. Mm-hmm. So the only thing that was there was the orb in a very crude and not as fun way as it ended up being, but mm-hmm. it was there, and that was like the cornerstone of the game, and there was something there, the co-op with the like the reverse football. There was some interesting things there, so we just had to build a game around that. So it was like a red thread throughout the development that we could like. It always has to support the orb in some way. So the characters were way different, and everything. When I joined the arena, or the whole game was in one arena, and it was like a Colosseum. And then actually that arena is in Force One. It's the one with the laser. If anybody played Force, mm-hmm. it was like a sand Colosseum. And then the whole game was going to be in like one or two arenas, and that arena would transform. But there were no like progression, level progression feeling, and it was very limited what we can do there. So one of the big like decisions was to have, what did we win? 25 arenas or something instead of 3. Mm-hmm. But yeah. But the orb was there when I joined, and it was there when we released. So that was like a cornerstone that we could like cling on to when we went out.
Mm-hmm. And with that original concept of Force, I remember when I spoke with Stefan about this, that it really did, as you just said, Pierre, change a lot from that original design. When when you came on board and you started to make these changes to Force, one thing that I remember that was very unique about the game was sort of using like the orb as, you know, you're passing between the multiple players and using it to solve puzzles. Was that something that you came up with, or is that something that was like there before you got in?
It's hard. Game development is a very like a group process, so it's hard to say that I came up with. But we as a team came up with the idea that the orb should be more involved in the levels, and not just in the beginning. It was only used in combat, so it was like you had to, in order to get mana to use your spells, you had to have the orb, and so you had to share it. So it was like this shared mana pool, which wasn't fun. so we changed it to that the orb could help you in the arenas by activating shrines that would like explode or something. And then that could, then in turn, we had to teach the players how to use those helpful shrines. And by doing that, we put like mandatory shrines that you had to turn on to progress. So it kind of grew organically. I don't know if there was like a certain flick of a switch where we decided now it's based on level puzzles, or it came more naturally that we wanted more progression in arenas, and then we wanted a new thing each arena, or at least each chamber. We wanted something new and fresh, and the best way to do that while also using the orb was that the orb was key to solving that or succeeding in that arena.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was like a collaborative effort that that the orb was the center focus.
Okay, cool. So following Fours, I know the game did all right for Bad Dwarf. You guys,
yeah, Fours was a huge success.
Yeah, and
for us,
it definitely gave you guys the momentum needed to expand on things. And when I was speaking with Stefan about this, I think it was, again, I've had so many interviews, it's hard to remember. I think it was,
yeah,
I think it was late 2014, maybe. He was talking about this idea for Force Showdown, which I think at the time was being called something else.
Yeah, that's a little annoying thing about the whole Force Showdown was that at first we wanted to call it Force 2, mm-hmm. but as you might know, it's very different from Force, yeah. And it was confusing players a lot that why is this Force 2? This is nothing like Force. Mm-hmm. So we wanted a totally new name, so we called it Eternal Arenas. Mm-hmm. But it turned out, and we actually, our whole Kickstarter was branded as, it was branded as Eternal Arenas. Mm-hmm. And then it turned out that some Chinese company, the week after we decided on Eternal Arenas, they trademarked and launched a game, or at least trailers for a game called Eternal Arena. Mm-hmm. And they very strongly suggested that we should change our name. Otherwise, they would probably end bad for us. Mm. So we weren't sued or anything like that, but we probably would have been if we didn't change it. And then we were pretty frustrated because it took a long time to come up with the Eternal Arena's name. And we also had already screenshots out there and videos out there and the whole Kickstarter out there where it was called Eternal Arenas, and now we had to rebrand it to a name we didn't know what was. So after a lot of brainstorming, it became Force Showdown because we still wanted the Force, or we thought at the time that having the Force would help us because then people, it was like a shared universe or brand, something like Star Wars Battlefront. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily the same as another Star Wars game, but you can recognize the Star Wars name, but it turned out that people still thought it was gonna be similar to Force One, which is not, because Force One is co-op focused, multiplayer focused, mm-hmm. and Showdown is single player focused, and that really upset some players or some users that they expected. That we made a co-op game because our first game was a co-op game. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and as you're saying, Peter, like the difference between the two is pretty much night and day, especially just in terms of everything about, in terms of the progression, the big thing that when I talked with Stefan about that got me interested was the CCG mechanics that you guys added with the cards and setting up decks for each of the game's classes or characters, I mean. I guess my first question then for you, Peter, regarding Force Showdown is where did the idea come from to sort of take this radical transition from the original Force to Showdown?
I think it was short after Force 1, we were kind of invincible. Like we were the best, so we wanted to try something new. And roguelikes were pretty interesting at that point. So we came up with the idea of having our action combat, but in a roguelike setting where you constantly got new arenas and new enemies and so on. But then we also wanted to add progression. So the original prototype was arenas, and then after each arena, you would get like a talent tree choice. Mm-hmm. So that was like the first pitch. And then Hearthstone came out, and we all loved Hearthstone at the office, and card games were huge at that point. And we thought, why not, instead of you choosing random talents, you draw a random card, and that is your like upgrades for the arena. So that is that was like the basis for Showdown, was this roguelike, but instead of finding random upgrades like you do in other roguelikes, you build a deck and you draw random upgrades instead. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was way different, and that was sort of the point that we wanted. I think we were just maybe a little fatigued with forced co-op and wanted to try something different, and was sort of hoping that it would probably also be co-op, but that turned out to be much harder than we anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also probably why we didn't go for a forced co-op, was because the launch of Forced One was pretty tough on us because the co-op was working only 80% of the time. So we would still have a lot of people complaining about not being able to connect or it being buggy and stuff like that. And for any indie devs out there, adding multiplayer, especially online multiplayer, is just making your problems 10 times worse.
Oh yes.
So yeah. So I think we were like trying to avoid that again.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing that I hear from, it's kind of funny, for every like consumer I hear or I listen to what they're saying, they say multiplayer is easy, you don't need to do much to add it. And then every developer I speak to is, it's a living nightmare. don't add it unless you are, you know, really really wanting it.
Yeah, so I looking back at Showdown now, I understand why people thought the way they did, and I don't blame people for expecting co-op and online multiplayer similar to Forced One, because they were sort of like that. They were like, that's what you're good at. You made a really good co-op game. Why would you do something completely different? That's mm-hmm. insane. And it might have been. We should probably have done a Force 2, but mm-hmm. now we have our co-op IP or co-op game and our single player roguelike mm-hmm. game. So that's fun, I guess.
Now, with Force Showdown, a lot of what makes that game interesting, especially from a mechanic and system perspective, is the kind of balancing you guys did in terms of not just the different characters you have in the game and their abilities, but as well as the whole deck system and the ability to have all these different powers, upgrades, etc. I guess to start with, how did you decide on, I guess, the characters that you wanted the player to be in the game?
Yeah, so starting out, we took the characters from Forced One, the hammer and the bow
mm-hmm.
That were in Forced One. They are called Volko and Stormbringer in Showdown, and they were like because we wanted a melee and a range, mm-hmm. because then we had something like to go from. Turns out that also a little tip. It's way easier to make a game that is pure melee or pure ranged. Balancing both melee and ranged is super, super challenging. But that's a side note. So we started out with that, and then we sort of wanted to make a new character, and it was the four-armed Ravager that was supposed to be the equivalent of the knife guy from Forced One, which is a fast roguelike character.
Mm-hmm.
Roguelike, but like a rogue type character, and so that was the third, I think. And then we made a totally new type of character, which is this Squire of Light with a beam. And funny story is that he was like the last of those four to be made, but he is now the starting character because he's perfect for teaching mm-hmm. people twin stick shooting, because he has that continuous beam, and then they themselves figure out that they can move and fire the laser at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's perfect for a starting character, so he became the starting character. But that's how they got made.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting what you just said regarding melee and range, or having games that are one or the other. And that was one of the things I was noticing about when I played Showdown at the time, that it kind of felt like it was more balanced towards, it felt like it was easier to do range, I think, in that game, just to do the sheer overwhelming number of enemies. And you're right about that, Pierre, that when you're having to balance two completely different styles of play, it becomes that much harder in terms of balancing what the enemies can do, what kind of abilities you want to give the player, and so on.
Yeah, like take any enemy. Either it's too hard for melee or it's trivial for range. It's like it's super hard to find that enemy that is fun for both, mm-hmm. basically. We tried some crazy stuff. We have an enemy that gives itself a shield if you are too far away.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of like forcing the reins to get closer and stuff like that. But you can't, that is, first of all, it's not super intuitive. So it's you can't have a lot of that. Then the players are going to be super confused.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, it works sometimes. Some enemies are fine for both, but usually the reins will just stay at a distance and pick enemies off, and they will never get a chance to reach you. Or you'll just be, if you're melee and you go close to an enemy, they will just shoot whatever rocket they have, and you don't have a chance to dodge it because you're in melee range. But it can't fly too slow because then the reins dude will have no trouble dodging it at all. And yeah, it's just it gave a lot of challenges for especially for our enemy balancing, mm-hmm. and boss balancing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that can also extend with the card design as well, because you have a very wide range of cards that the player can build their decks from. As you guys were building this kind of deck system, what kind of, I guess, philosophy or balance were you trying to, I guess, do with the CCG elements?
We wanted to, the card should feel impactful, but not like game changing in a like coin flippy way. Mm-hmm. So if I get this card, I win, or if I don't, I lose. So all cards had to be somewhat good and interesting, but also not just win you the game. So cards that were just giving you too much damage or too much life have been tweaked a lot and are now like four times less than they were in the beginning, because the simple but strong cards players will gravitate towards opposed to like a little more complicated or combo-ish cards that are harder to use but are also strong, but they will usually take the simple strong cards. So the simple strong cards were tweaked down, and the a little more complicated cards like consumables were buffed since launch, because we wanted the players to try out some stuff and not just go for the boring plus damage or plus health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now with that kind of card design, I know you guys have spent a lot of time in terms of balancing and fine-tuning, and this is especially true when you start having the characters themselves, who not only have their own cards, but make use of everything else as well.
Yeah, I think in the beginning, it would the characters didn't have their own cards, but then quickly we wanted to mimic the Hearthstone model, where each character feels very special to play because they have their own cards. But that also doubles quadruples the workload, because then you have to make cards for each, and they also have to be balanced between the characters, so it's not. The cards for Squire shouldn't be better than the cards for Walco, because then players would just play that character instead. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there was a lot of cross balance, and it was super hard to balance cross the characters because they were so different. So yeah, in the beginning, there were many neutrals, shared cards, but now they have a lot of, I think, 12 or more per class or character, so you can really tweak your abilities. Yeah, also what we've found out that was a lot more fun to do was actually making cards that changed or upgraded your abilities rather than just having the neutral cards that give you damage. But that meant that, like, if we say this card gives you another overcharge after you fire the first overcharge on Squire, that card can't even be used on the other classes. So we were like, if that's the most fun thing to upgrade, then we have to make class cards or whatever you call them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess in terms of those class cards, one thing that I found interesting is that unlike a traditional CCG where you have these cards that radically affect a character, and I mean, we can easily use Hearthstone as an example of this with some of their play-changing cards or their legendaries. The cards in for Showdown, they all act in terms of like supplemental to the character. So something like with Ravager, for instance, who I think is that's my main at the moment, he gets cards like some of his abilities let him maybe have an AoE when he does his burst attack, or lets him gain more fury from attacks.
Yeah, the Ravager is a super interesting character because people, the first time people play him, they think he's super weak.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually think his skill ceiling is higher than most characters. If you remember to use all your abilities, mm-hmm. especially the last one, the Enrage one,
mm-hmm.
people often forget to use. I even forget to use it sometimes.
Yes.
So we made a card that upgrades that ability to give that burst, and it's really helpful, but also makes him stronger in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and it can be very hectic to play the game as well. Like one of the things I thought was very interesting that I want to ask you about, Peter, is when you get later into the game, like for those of you who haven't played Showdown, once you get past, I guess, the first arena or the first program, the later programs introduce the concept that when you're fighting through each level, that the quote-unquote boss character at the end has their own deck of cards that they can play and effectively influence the state of the game. And they have cards that either will affect just one arena in that battle, or they can affect everything going forward. And the variety there is quite insane when you look at some of their options. I've seen stuff that lets them add totems to the field, supercharge some of the characters, even add new characters.
Yeah.
On that front, Peter, in terms of, I guess, giving the enemy like their own little toolbox of tricks to use, how did you guys approach that front?
Well, it's, again, came from the idea that we wanted to mimic Hearthstone, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So in Hearthstone, you play cards based on your opponents, or at least most decks do. There are some face aggro decks that doesn't care what the opponent casts, but at least you have to react to what the opponent does. And we felt that it would be fun to add that to our game, that in this arena, you better be ready for fast enemies or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we gave the bosses the kind of the same tools as the player had, a little different because they are not a character until the last stage. But yeah, it felt fair for the bosses to also be throwing cards, and we were hoping that it could vary the game a bit more, because it is roguelike at heart, and part of the fun but also challenge of roguelikes is that you never really know what to expect because it's randomized every time.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was up the randomness for the bosses while also giving them some interesting tools similar to the player that the player could react to or just like mix it up a bit.
Mm-hmm. And as we were saying earlier, in terms of balancing all these different elements to it, that's also like for every new card you add in or every new ability, it can easily throw the game balance completely out of alignment.
Yeah, especially challenges you face, like boss cards or the modifiers that we also have.
Yeah.
each battle had each, you can choose which battle you want to take, and each battle has different modifiers or battle rules, I think we call them, which change the game in some way. It can be positive for you, but then there's more enemies, or it can be bad for you, and then there's less enemies. So it's not that it's easy or hard, it's just different.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some of those modifiers, especially because it's like, it's not something you can really do anything about once you go into the battle. You just kind of have to deal with it. And there were some of those that were too critical for the player. Mm-hmm. Like, especially anything that had to do with life. Like, sometimes we wanted, wouldn't it be fun if the player started at half life or something? And because that's a different challenge. Now you have to really mind your health or something. But people were, it was not everybody responds well to just losing half your life suddenly. So we had to go pull a little back on those modifiers.
Yeah.
Then we later added like an emblem system. Mm-hmm. where it's optional if you want to play with these extra difficulties. Mm-hmm. So the ones who don't mind this crazy challenge can just choose it for themselves.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I think I may have suggested that in one of my posts too about the game, about that kind of being able to give the player more control over their options. And that's one of the things that's very interesting about Four Showdown, is that there are so many randomized elements at work that can affect how you play a game. As you just said, Peter, we have your own deck. You have the characters you play, the character you play. You have what kind of arena the game will spawn. You have the bosses. You have modifiers. And you even have their cards. And that's just a whole lot of elements that can lead to wildly different experiences for each player.
Yeah, and that's for good and for ill. Mm-hmm. Like, it's fun that it's can be totally different, but it can also be frustrating.
Yeah.
That's, you never know what to expect.
Definitely. Now, one thing that I wanted to also touch on that I thought was very interesting in terms of how you guys set this up. As you said a few minutes ago, obviously Force Showdown doesn't have co-op multiplayer. And again, that probably would have driven you guys crazy to add that in. But it does feature a pretty extensive multiplayer community kind of setup. You have daily plays, weekly, you have leaderboards. There's even, yeah. I know you guys did a lot with Twitch integration functionality, with having, you know, people can like you and give you rewards, and just trying to build that sense of community with the game. Could you
definitely
talk a little bit about, I guess, implementing those kinds of mechanics to the game?
Yeah, so ever since we basically made For Showdown, we were constantly wondering what we could do to build a community around a roguelike game.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things early on was that we thought of was the daily challenge, where everybody played the same seed.
Mm-hmm.
So players could talk about it, or even like ask someone else or watch a video on YouTube of the daily challenge to see what they were coming up against, because everybody got a random but the same seed. So that was sort of the beginning of it. And then we wanted to expand on that, and we made different modes, different daily mm-hmm. modes, because there was some talk that one time daily, like one try, would really make people research the dailies, or like talk about it and try this daily. You only have one try, so see how far you can get. But we also wanted, we didn't want people just quitting after they died or completed it. So we also have the daily you can try as many times you want to see, and constantly progress and see how far you can get. And then we also came up with the equality daily, that is basically we give you a champion and a deck, so you don't even have to have a lot of cards unlocked. You can just play on equal footing with everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So those were the dailies that we had the ideas for. So we had to implement them in some way. And then we had depending on how well you do in those dailies, you get some season points, and then we have a season ranking. And in the beginning, we had some physical rewards. Actually, you could win prizes based on how good you were. But you had to stream for that. So that was sort of our way to both trying to build a community around Twitch, but also like make sure people weren't cheating or or anything. But also, it was just super interesting to see those crazy times that our hardcore users did, like times that we couldn't even manage to get. It was fun to see how they played, which card they played, and so on. And just see how they play the game.
But
since then, we want to expand the community across both Forced and Forced Showdown. So we made a community like website where the community, by signing up to our newsletter, subscribe to our newsletter, they level up like sort of the site, this community level, and then they get unlock rewards based on that. So we give out free rewards like in-game skins and so on. If you go to betadwarf.com/community, you can sign up, and then there's we just every week or something we send out keys, Steam keys with free DLC for people. So stuff like that. We constantly doing stuff to treat our community, so to say.
Now, one question I want to ask you about, Peter, and going back with more like, again, like the card system and sort of like the overall philosophy of Forced Showdown. One of the things I found interesting is, especially after you said a few minutes ago regarding how the original version of Force was going to be like had like Facebook and monetization elements to it and IAP, stuff like that. And one thing about Force Showdown that it could have probably gone in a very different direction was how you get more cards in the game. There's always, like, for example, when we talk about Hearthstone, you can get cards for free, but the main way, of course, is spending money on the different booster packs and such. With Force Showdown, you have the slot machine or the slot machine kind of mechanic of deciding, you know, you get a random selection depending upon what you land on. What was it like? What was the decision behind deciding how the player would get more cards or essentially build their decks out of them?
Yeah, so initially, when we made the cards, we were like, we can't just give everybody all the cards to start with. There has to be some way to unlock the cards, because that's just how a game should be. You shouldn't have every tool and the best deck straight away. You should like earn that deck. But we didn't want, I think early on, it's hard to remember, but I'm pretty sure that we decided to make a premium game, like a game with a cost straight away. And so then it was a no-brainer for us that every gameplay element in the game should be unlockable if you have the base game. So yeah, it was not even a big decision that we shouldn't have like in-app purchases in Showdown for cards and so on, since it's gameplay related. I can only speak for myself, but I'm personally a big fan of Valve's philosophy with like Dota, where you have all gameplay available, but there's nothing gameplay related you can buy. It's only cosmetics, and that was sort of the same approach in For Showdown, that we didn't want stuff behind a paywall. We've then since made the expansion, but it's a cheap and big expansion to the game. And even if you buy the expansion, you won't get the cards. You still have to unlock them, and not by paying for them. You have to actually play the game, since we don't see it as something to buy. We just see it as more content you can unlock.
Yeah, and It's very tricky, especially, again, when you're presenting this to the consumer. As we've seen, free-to-play in-app purchases, monetization, can really rob consumers the wrong way. And I think you guys did the right thing with Four Showdown, especially when you compare it to something like Hearthstone, in how they do have a lot of ways to essentially buy your own decks. But I would say a big difference, though, is that Hearthstone is a strictly CCG game. There's no...
But it's also free.
Yeah. That's also a good point. But it's all. But it's not a game where the player's own skill or control is going to come into play. When you're playing for Showdown, if you can't... If you don't know how to properly move your character around or dodge attacks, you're dead. There's no deck combination that will save you if you just stand there while, I forget her name, the tank boss of the second program shoots that blast at you. You're not going to just walk away from that one.
Even if you could buy cards in our game, you wouldn't be able to pay to win anyway, because as you said, that's only half the game. You still have to actually be good at the game.
Yeah.
So, but I think that's also why we chose to make it a premium game that you buy, and then this is the game, and then the card element is not. That's just a way to give you tools in game. It's not the game. Whereas I think it's okay in Hearthstone that they charge money, because the game is free, and I've played Hearthstone for, I don't know, probably 400 hours, and I haven't spent any money. And it's so you can play Hearthstone without paying. And I think it's fair that if you want to speed up the process of getting cards, they'll allow it. So it's for players of Hearthstone, I think, just to defend that a little, it's just do you value time more than money? Then you buy cards. If you value money more than time, then you grind cards.
Yeah.
So I think it's great that in Hearthstone you can actually get cards even though you don't pay. So at least have that.
Yeah.
It's a good start.
Yeah, and you beat me to it, Pierre. I was about to say that as well. Going back with Valve and Team Fortress 2, they had pretty much the same philosophy with how they developed the item shop and the items in game. And again, it goes back to what the consumer values more. Do they value their time more, or do they value their pocketbook or their checkbook? And different consumers will value things differently. There are people who just want to spend the money, get it over with, and start using it. Just there's people who they don't want, a free purchase or a $20 game to skyrocket to $200, $300 worth of in-app purchases and whatnot. And with Team Fortress 2 and by extension for Showdown, a lot of these items, or in Force's case, the cards, as we've said, they're not making the game winnable. Or as we said, it's not quote-unquote pay to win.
Yeah, exactly.
If you play for Showdown, if you don't know how to properly use your character, no card combination will save you. Just as in Team Fortress 2, it doesn't matter what weapon or items you buy for your classes. If you don't know how to properly use the Heavy or the Demo Man or whatever, there's nothing that's going to make you a better player with these items.
Yeah, and it's the pay to win argument, people always think of it very binary. Either it's pay to win or it's not, but it's more a sliding scale.
Yes.
So something like Team Fortress is not pay to win. You can't buy stuff and get better. You have to actually be good. And same with Dota. It's not pay to win because you can only buy non-gameplay stuff.
Yes.
A little more towards pay to win, there's something like League of Legends. It's still quite good, and consumers like League of Legends because they're pretty fair. There's still the hero rotation, and you can get most of the stuff by grinding points and then just buy the heroes or champions that you like. And then you can go even then you get over in the more pay to win area of the slider, which is something like Clash of Clans or something, mm-hmm. where the grinding of or the upgrading of the cards in Clash of Clans takes so long that you can argue that it's if you don't spend money, you can never win versus the ones who did spend money and stuff like yeah. that. So it's always a sliding scale, and I just think it's important not to be on the wrong side of that pay to win
definitely
scale.
And I mean, for me, like I made a post about this a while ago that still gets people bringing it up whenever there's an argument over pay to win. That for me, a game is pay to win when there is content that can only be purchased using real money or premium currency that uniquely and positively impacts the game experience.
Yeah,
as you
gives
said,
you an itch.
And it's very tricky. Again, I think you have a good point there, Peter, regarding that sliding scale or sliding scope or slope. Sorry, of going from no monetization tactics to something, you know, like full-blown Farmville, you know, pay $20 or your farm will die kind of thing.
Yeah, so especially PC players like Steam users, mm-hmm. which is our platform, will react strongly if they see those shady tactics.
Yes.
But as a company philosophy, we also dislike it a lot.
Yeah.
So we try to stay away from that and do what we feel is right and what the players usually feel is fair.
Yeah, and we could easily, I think, spend another hour or so talking about free-to-play and monetization tactics because it's a very multi-layer issue. And I think you made a good point there, Peter, regarding Steam. PC users and consumers on that front are just vehemently opposed to microtransactions. And in some cases, they are even opposed to DLC. We've seen too many examples of games where, you know, someone sees like a page of DLC, they'll just like run away from that game in droves. And that challenge, again, is figuring out that balance of just exactly how much should these elements impact the game or especially impact the player's wallets? Because as we've seen, especially with the mobile front, it is very easy to add any kind of monetization element to almost any kind of game design. We've seen so many less than reputable mobile games and even some less than reputable early access or greenlight games go that route of just very poor quality. And it only takes one bad apple to spoil the whole bunch.
Yeah, and we of course have to look at it both from what is a wise business decision and what is consumer friendly.
Yes.
And often they go hand in hand because oftentimes you can't get away with this shit. Like personally, I'm against pre-ordering and season passes. I think it's very weird that you buy something before you know what you're buying, just in general. But on the same side, it's a very good business decision because I know why companies do it. We don't do it, but I know why companies do it because they can estimate their sales numbers and stuff like that and earn money even before the game comes out. So I understand why they do it. What I don't understand is why so many still pre-order games and buy season passes. But that's just people, I guess, not voting with their wallets like they should be.
Yeah. And
but in the same time, we also did a Kickstarter, which is a little similar to pre-ordering, actually. It's like, This is the game. Hopefully, we can deliver. Do you believe in us?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I can sort of see both sides of the argument.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering if you had a chance to read my post I put up talking about pre-orders on Game Wisdom, because I just did a post about that. And well, for those of you listening to this cast, it'll probably be like a few weeks, but it just went up a few days ago from when we're actually sitting here talking. And it's that whole pre-order mentality has really shifted. And I'm, I think, right with you about that, Pierre, that I really don't pre-order games unless it's like some kind of super fancy collector's edition that I love. But
for the physical makes sense, but yeah. I should have made that clear. Physical pre-ordering is sort of makes sense if it's like there's a limited amount of physical copies, but digital pre-ordering, it just it boggles my mind.
No, there's infinite copies. It's not like Steam. If Steam ever runs out copies of a game, I think that's an anachronism. I think that will cause the universe to collapse on itself. But it is a very different market these days. And as I said in my post, I don't think pre-ordering in what people used to use it for no longer really applies. And again, even with console games, I don't need to go to a store. I can order it on Amazon or Newegg or anything like that. And even on that front, it's very rare for a game to just completely sell out these days. Especially, and as we're just saying, with the PC side of things, with PC and Steam now just almost, you know, symbiotically connected to each other, it's very rare for a PC game to run out of copies.
Yeah, I guess it can't happen unless the servers get overloaded or something, but then you can't play the game anyway. So I don't know. Digitally, it shouldn't be an issue with pre-ordering. Yeah. But I know why they do it. It's a it makes sense for the company. If we could do it, we probably would. But I don't think we can. I don't think we will do it.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know.
I guess in terms of this cast, Peter, I know we are approaching the hour, and again, it is late where you are, so I don't want to keep you all night long in Denmark. So,
no worries.
I do have a few set of final questions. I think thing that I want to talk about especially is the future of Showdown, as well as the recent expansion. So, I guess the first part of that would be, as we've said, you guys have released by the time you're listening to this cast, it's been out for a few months now, the first expansion for Showdown, which would be the drone invasion.
Yeah.
I guess my question for you about that, Peter, is how did you approach building an expansion for a game like Showdown?
Yeah, so that is it was actually part of the like initial plan of Showdown was to expand it so we built a lot of systems so we could later expand it and if you look at the Force Showdown update history, there's a lot of content patches as well that is just free, that is here's a new cards, here's a new boss, or here's the whole emblem system, or bonus battles was also just, we wanted to improve the game by adding some random or some arenas that were just fun bonus battle, where you could do something very different and stuff like that. So we kind of had the idea that we would constantly update the game, and we're still doing that. I'm still working on updates for the game right now, but the drone invasion came as we wanted to do a new campaign because we wanted to try a little more exploration. I don't know if you've tried the program that is drone invasion specific. It's like a maze.
Yeah.
You explore and you can find gold and you don't really know which way to go and stuff like that. So it's more roguelike exploration, which we felt was a little lacking in the main programs because that was just a choice and then straight ahead. So we wanted a little more like maze-like exploration. Mm-hmm. So that became a pretty big update, especially once we added the new character. Which was, we wanted to have more ranged characters because they're super fun to play. And we wanted to have more ranged enemies because we wanted to make it a little more volatile. So it ended up being this very big package of drone-themed stuff. And so it grew to this giant expansion, and we felt it was it seemed fair to, if you wanted more, if you wanted to basically expand the game, you could pay a little more, because since the game, the base game is pretty cheap and the expansion is pretty cheap, you can buy both pretty cheap. So it's just a way to expand the game in a different direction, whereas the updates will expand the game with more of the same, or it will at least feed into the same loop.
Yeah,
and we couldn't do that with the with the maze.
Mm-hmm. And I think you made a really good point there, Pierre, regarding the foundation of Showdown being really strong for continued growth and expansion. And I think you guys have a really great foundation. It's one of the things that we see with a lot of these games built around like CCG progression or just like a really strong core feedback loop, whether it's Hearthstone, Team Fortress, Forced, and other games of their kind. It's the basic of the game just allows you to take it in a lot of different directions, and you can either do that with extending or expanding on systems, like as you said with the emblem, or by just adding supplemental new content, whether it's in the form of new cards, new enemies, new programs, etc.
Yeah, we have it's both like a pro and a con for the game, but we have a lot of different systems, like the emblems, modifiers, boss cards, so on. So we have a lot of areas where we can expand. And we internally we've made a lot of tools so that it's fairly easy. So I can make new cards pretty fast, like gameplay wise. They still require some art. That is why it usually takes a while for us to make new cards, especially cards, because it requires card art.
Yeah.
But other than that, the game is tailored to be expanded upon, and that's definitely something that we want to keep doing for as long as the players want it. And we're very active on the Steam discussions page, the forums, where people would suggest different cards or something, and or balance changes. Like shortly after the Drone Invasion was released, people were pretty certain that the new character Setsu was a bit too strong. So shortly after, we released a patch where we tweaked it, nerfed it a bit, but also tweaked some other places that were maybe too weak, like the old characters. So because we released the new expansion, we changed the old game, because we made the old characters a little better or more up to par with each other. And even though you didn't buy the new expansion, you would still benefit of those tweaks and improvements. So it the expansion helps everyone, I guess. It's my point. But yeah, we listened to the community, and it was like a week ago, someone said, I saw randomly someone saying, the sniper rats, I feel like they have too much life because they can also go invisible. And I was like, yeah, he's probably right, because if you can't find them most of the time, that's almost like extra life for them. So maybe their base health should be lower. So I just wrote to him, that sounds like a good idea. I will do that right away. And and we did that, and then released the patch like a week or 3 days later or something. And stuff like that is super, super fun to do and super satisfying for me, and hopefully also for the player who suggested that.
And that kind of rapid iteration or rapid expanding and patching has really become a major part of a lot of games on Steam, especially with a game like Force and Force Showdown being very community-driven as well. And I'm just wondering, I'm not sure if you know the answer to this or not, Peter, but how has the game been doing, like, I guess, reception-wise? Because I can see, like, from my end, I see it has a lot of great reviews. But for you guys, how is, like, I guess, the game in terms of, like, reaction or, I guess, being successful for the company?
Yeah. So if I take on, from a design perspective, I'm very happy. This reviews are great. Players, the players who love it really love it. Like, surprisingly, people played for hours on end, and that's super satisfying to see, and the reviews are great and so on. But then with the business head on, we didn't sell as much as Forced 1. Mm-hmm. But we took quite a while to make Forced Showdown because it was so iterative and we're trying new stuff. So on that front, when we launched, it was a bit disappointing, but we probably just got a shot of realistic, like mm-hmm. we should have been a bit more realistic that we couldn't make a first one again. We should have probably been more happy I don't know how to say it, but it's like mm-hmm. first one was bigger than we gave it credit, and then we thought that we could do the same again and we couldn't, but since then with the drone invasion and constant updates and community efforts, it's actually grown a bit and now it's doing fine, and mm-hmm. and the constant sales we get is also pretty good for the company, that we constantly get this revenue stream from Showdown. So it started off a bit disappointing with the initial sale, and I think it was more like a marketing hype sort of thing, that we were pretty overshadowed by the other games coming out at that time, like Into the Gungeon and Hyperlight Drifter. Those games that feel like a real indie game, whereas I think our message was a little muddied because we wanted to do so much with the cards and so on. Some people didn't really know what it was. And I'm not blaming people, I'm blaming us, that we didn't know how to communicate it, and that hurt our sales numbers in the beginning. But since then, we changed some stuff on the Steam page and made it more clear, and when people understand it, they actually like it. So that's at least great, that it's more of a marketing issue more than a gameplay, game mm-hmm. design issue. That being said, they kind of feed into each other. If you have a clear pitch that helps a clear game pitch that helps the marketing. So I think some people thought it was like a mobile game or something because of the cards and the top-down viewers. No, I don't know. We've heard people that was very surprised when they actually played that it was not what they expected at all. So I think the communication hurt the sales a lot. Mm-hmm. But since then, it's been growing, and it's been nice to see that the forums are still active and so on.
Yeah, and it's great to hear that, Pierre. I've been playing it on and off, especially after I had a chance to try out the Drone Invasion. I still really enjoy the game. I'd love to do more with the streaming aspects of it, but I just can't seem to get people to watch me. I think I may not be popular enough on it. But as you said, that's also part of marketing and trying to get the word out there.
Yeah, I think it's just it's a different time these days, yeah. because there's so many games coming out every day, and it's like everyone is fighting for the attention of the audience. And sometimes even great games get overlooked, but you don't know that because you mm-hmm. didn't look at it because they got overlooked. So yeah. it's like people say, just do what Minecraft did or whatever, but it's it's a survivor bias. Like you know about these games because they were hyped well or viral or whatever. So I don't know. We also a small studio and we do everything ourselves. So, and we prefer making games and not doing marketing, but we have to do both because otherwise people won't know that our game is coming out. But that's also why we are focusing more on our community and trying to grow that. So we don't have to rely on press writing about our games. Mm-hmm. We can actually just go directly to our community and say, check this out, we are making a new game, mm-hmm. which we are.
Cool. That's a good lead into my next set of questions, and thank you, Peter. I guess to begin to wrap things up then, let's touch on the future of Beta Dwarf. So first, let's talk more about Forced Showdown. As we've said, of course, the Drone Invasion, your first major expansion for the game. You guys have been continuing to do more patch updates, whether it's in terms of balancing or adding in both major and minor content. I guess for you, Peter, and for the rest of Beta Dwarf, do you see more, I guess, major content, either more expansions or more systems coming to Force Showdown in the future?
Yeah, like I said, I'm right now I'm actually working on cards for Zetsu, the new champion, mainly because we launched that champion with 8 cards that you could get. You started with 4, then you could find the remaining 4, while the other ones have 12 and up. So we want to bring Zetsu up to those around those 12 cards. So that's what I'm working on now, as well as some other content that we're not really sure what is right now, but it could be anything from I think it's going to be themed decks for the dailies, so people can try out some cards they don't have and stuff like that. And maybe even try out drone cards that so they don't have to buy the expansion to try out the dismantle mechanic and stuff like that. But that's just the near future. In the distant future, we probably want to make more free content updates because we strongly believe in games as a service. I don't know if you heard that term, but it's in the olden days, you released the game and that was it. You forgot about it. But today, people just expect that a game is a living, breathing thing. And we strongly believe in that. So we want to, especially a game like Showdown that is so suitable for updates, we want to update that for as long as it makes sense. We're totally working on updates.
Yeah, and that's good to hear, especially about adopting the games as a service approach. And as you said, Peter, for those of you listening to the cast right now, games as a service revolves around continued support and basically keeping the game going for as long as it's financially feasible. And there are so many game examples of that right now. I think the 2 or 3 we've probably mentioned several times in this cast already would be Team Fortress, Dota 2 / League of Legends, and of course Hearthstone. And
basically any Blizzard game will get updates 10 years.
Yeah, didn't they just do an update for Diablo 2 like a few months ago?
I think it's like now we support full resolution, so something. They crazy.
Yeah, and it is a very interesting time around that because when it works, you pretty much have a game that not only do you have a stable fan base for, but it's producing enough income for you to keep going. And you can just take that game and, you know, go any number of directions with it. Whereas in the past, again, as you were just saying, Pierre, it was pretty much like fire and forget. You put the game out, it makes its sales, maybe you'll get a little bit of boost during a holiday season, but it's done. Like, you're not going back to that game 6 months, 12 months down the line.
No, totally. And you can see companies who do this well, like Blizzard, who just updated StarCraft 1. It came out in 98. So Blizzard and Valve are two companies that are hugely successful today, but they sort of started this whole games as service philosophy and kept updating the games for a long time after release. And yeah, that's just that's how it is today, and people expect that, and that's cool.
Yeah, and I mean, that's another hour-long topic very easily we could get into. I mean, it is really amazing. Everyone who listens to these casts know that they need to take a shot every time we bring up Valve or Steam, because it's a common topic here about just how much they've influenced both making games as well as selling them. Now, and again, who knows how long we could spend on that. I guess my final question for you then for tonight, Pierre, before we start to wrap things up. Yeah. As you said, of course, you may be working on another game at the moment. So I don't know how much you can get into details, obviously, right now. But for the folks listening, can you give us any teasers about what's coming next from Beta Dwarf?
Yeah, sure. But so to lead into that, even though we are working on our third game, that doesn't mean that we are stopping development on the the other games, because we actually, as a, it's more of a business thing, but we actually decided to, because First Showdown took so long and didn't sell as much as it should compared to the development cost of a long game like that, we wanted to try a little quicker development time, but also, but it may sound counterintuitive, but also split up the team. So not all of the team, but some people will work. Like, for instance, Stephanie is very focused on the game director at Beta Dwarf is very focused on the next game, while I'm sticking around for Showdown updates. And then at some point, I'll probably go to the fourth game or something like that in the future. But we want to keep the company a little more on its toes and not make a 2-year project. So the next game we're making is I can tease that it might be a smaller game than Showdown, but it's gonna be a PvP game, which people have been asking about why don't you just add PvP to Force, or why don't you just add PvP to Showdown? And you can't just add PvP to games like that. It's gonna be terrible. But we are trying to make the next game is gonna be a PvP game. But it's gonna be set in the same universe, but very different from our other games. But the reason why we're doing that and not doing something like a Force 2 is that we can make this in a very short time compared to like a new Force, which would take quite a while to make. We still want to do that, but right now we either need investment for a Force 2. Or we need to seriously scope it down, and we don't want to do that. If we were going to do a Force 2, we would make it better than Force 1 at least, and that would take a while. So, so I can tease that it's not Force 2, and that it's going to be a PvP type of game, and it's going to be feel very different than the other games, but it's going to be in the same universe, sort of. Yeah, I don't know how much I can say, actually. I don't know if we have a whole plan for it, but it's it's going to be fun to have a PvP game, because they are especially suited for a living game, because you constantly have to balance things depending on what is good and what is bad, and strong and weak, and updated with different content. But yeah, so it's not a MOBA. I can promise that.
Cool. And it's definitely interesting to hear what's going to be coming next from you guys. Because again, each one of, so far with both Force and Force Showdown, they're two completely different games. And
yeah, we like to try new things, even though it's probably not the best decision business wise to do, but we're doing this for fun, and we kind of want to push ourselves, I guess, and be the best game developers that we can be.
It'll be interesting. Again, definitely let me know when the game is coming out, or when you're able to show it all. I would love to check it out for the channel and everything.
Yeah, if you go to betadwarf.com/community, or you or anyone, you can sign up and you'll be the first to know, and probably also the first to get to play it, because we want to start testing it real soon, like with online testing, and that would require a lot of people for like matchmaking and so on. So definitely sign up and be the first to know about it, and actually the first and get a chance to be the first to play it also.
Cool. All right. I think with that, we will probably wrap things up here. I know we went over our estimate there. Quick pause here. When we say goodbye in like the next minute, just hang on for like 30 seconds. I just need to start encoding the audio, and then I can let you go. All right. Back to it in 3, 2, 1. All right. The next game sounds very interesting, Peter. I can't wait to see how it does for you guys, and especially see how well it will stand next to Forced and Forced Showdown. But we are definitely over our original estimate for the cast, so we're going to wrap it up here. Before we do that, though, I guess for you, Peter, my final question. Do you have any final thoughts or anything you'd like to say to the fans before we say goodnight?
I'll just say thanks to you for having me on. It was super fun. I always love talking design and just rambling about games. It's always fun. So thanks for talking with me. And thanks to anyone who ever played any of our games. That means a lot, even if you disliked it. Just the fact that you played something I made is kind of mind-boggling in a way. And thanks for that. especially you, because you actually played a lot of our games.
Thank you. All right. And so with that, we're going to say goodnight for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Peter, thanks again for coming on. And definitely good luck with continuing to develop Forced Showdown and
you.
Whatever your third unnamed title is at the moment. All right. So, for those of you listening, we're going to end things here. Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. If you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to submit a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted. We are always looking for new guests. If we can get enough, and hopefully if our Patreon continues to grow, we'll be able to have multiple casts during the week. Follow me. You can find me on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer for latest updates of new content as well as thoughts from me throughout the day. Be sure to check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. There's links to it on the front page. There you'll find my collections of Let's Breaks, video examinations, reviews, and even my daily vlog. All that great stuff is there, so be sure to check it out and subscribe. And last but not least, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom through the Patreon campaign, there are links to it on the front page, and you can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom. Donations will be greatly appreciated in order to get the monthly funding we need to keep going and growing. And if you donate, we have several great rewards there, as well as some interesting goals to add more content for everyone to enjoy. Be sure to check that out. So, again, Peter, thanks so much for coming on tonight, and hopefully we can have you and the rest of Bad Dwarf back on real soon, and I would love to, at some point, maybe do a live play of Showdown with you or Stefan or anyone else, and we can talk about the game live.
Yeah, that would be super fun. We should do that.
Awesome. All right. So, once again, thanks for tuning in. Hope you have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Have a great day, folks.